and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. This will be part two of our two-part series interview with Mohsen Malani, the author of Iran's Rise and Rivalry with the United States. In part one, the last episode, we left off talking about Iran's relationship with Hezbollah, Iran's role in creating Hezbollah, Lebanon's role in helping Shiize Iran, and so this very intertwined relationship. And so in this part two of our interview, we'll start off by clarifying some more aspects of the Iran-Hezbollah relationship and then discuss, as John had brought up at the end of the last part one, we'll talk a bit about the Houthis, their history, and where Iran comes in and what their relationship is. And then we'll finally bring it up to today because so much has changed from this structure that was set up by Soleimani. I have to say, as assassinations go, let's not forget, that was a consequential assassination.
Yes.
This was a unique, like Nasrallah, this was a uniquely talented figure. And
And the United States was perfectly willing to use that in order to crush Islamic State in Iraq. And they were patting him on the back right up to the moment that he became once again an enemy of the state. I mean, I don't want to whitewash his role. He was a very hard-nosed player in the international wars, and he had no love for the United States. But he took their help in order to crush Islamic State, for which, if there's such a thing as the civilized world, which I am not at all prepared to posit, then it owes him thanks for that.
Yeah. So, so let's get to, also Mohsen in this episode, we'll also talk about the importance of Assad Syria, or Syria under the Assads, and what a blow it was to lose that as well. So Iran has suffered a lot of blows, and then at the very end, he will sort of put it into context for today and going forward. And I think it's really interesting. So let's get right to our interview, part two of our interview with Mohsen Malani. What you can see here is that it's not like Iran came in and artificially created some Shia movement, that the relationship between the Shia in Lebanon and the Shia in Iran went back and forth and back and forth. And so that gets to the question of sort of autonomy versus, I don't know how much Hezbollah acted as they're generally in the sort of received ideas here in general discourse. They're described as a proxy. When we had Amal Saad on, of course, she debunked a lot of that thinking. I'm wondering where you come down on to what extent Hezbollah is controlled by Iran, or if it's more of a relationship, it's a lot more autonomous than that, and Iran has to really, respect that autonomy. And where does that come down?
I think my take on Hezbollah is that it is neither an independent entity nor a proxy, in a sense that you go ahead and create an organization that serves only and exclusively your interests. Mm-hmm. The idea of creating this organization, remember, there was already an organization by the name of Amal right around the time of the Islamic Revolution. So the question becomes, why did Iran need to create another organization?
Yeah.
The answer is that Ayatollah Khomeini didn't trust Amal as much as he wanted to. And the answer is that there were a lot of radical Lebanese Shiites and a lot of radical Iranian Shiites who believed that Amal and Mr. Berry himself specifically are leaning too much toward the West and are not sufficiently revolutionary and anti-Israel. Mm-hmm. The relationship between Amal and the Palestinians who were in Lebanon is a fascinating story. One of the key aspects of Moussa Sadr was that he his argument was that we need to decouple, and that's the key element. And if you understand that, I think if you agree with me, then your answer, your question is answered. Ayatollah Imam Moussa Sadr believed that the fate of the Shias in Lebanon is secured only if they can decouple the destiny of Palestinians from the Shias. Yes, he said, we need to have sympathy with the Palestinians, but first, we have to make sure that the Shias in Lebanon are taken care of. In other words, he had a more nationalistic view of the conflict in the Middle East, whereas the supporters of Ayatollah Khomeini and those who came out with the idea of creating Hezbollah had a more pan-Shi'i, pan-Islamic view that no, the fate of Palestinians is the central imperative of the Islamic movement. So when I said Hezbollah was a combination of the two, is that there is no way Hezbollah could have operated the way it did without Iranian support. I think anybody who says otherwise is being unfair. Iran has provided huge financial support to the Lebanese. It has been documented. The amount, of course, varies. Some people say it started with about $100 million a year, and the State Department by 2018, if I'm not mistaken, I don't have any notes, so I'm just telling you what I remember. I think the State Department estimated that by 2018, Iran was contributing about between $600 to $800 million a year. Now, I don't know if any of these numbers accurate, but I do know for sure is that Iran provided generous financial and military support. Having said that, here is where this issue of proxy, using the word proxy for Lebanon, becomes a little bit problematic. Mm-hmm. Every person that I've interviewed for my book about Lebanon, about Hezbollah, and I did few of those, they all tell me that when it came to Lebanese politics, Hezbollah had total autonomy. They did what they had to do. But when it came to the foreign policy of Hezbollah and its relationship with Israel, Iran had had to be consulted. Mm. And gradually that relationship evolved into a partnership. But a partnership in which I think Iranians respected the leadership of the Islamic Republic, respected the leadership of Hassan Nasrallah. But Hassan Nasrallah, before he died, candidly admitted that they get financial support from Iran, and without that support, they cannot survive.
Which is obviously influence. It's major influence, you know.
Yeah. I would say more than influence. I would say when it came to the key issues regarding foreign policy, regarding policy toward Israel, Iran played the key role, and Hezbollah essentially went along. If they could not convince the leadership in Iran, they would agree with Iran. Remember one thing about Hezbollah and its leadership. In Shia Islam, a faithful Shia follows one of the Ayatollahs, one of the grand Ayatollahs. And when I say follow, the exact translation is emulating an Ayatollah. What does that mean? It means that the religious decrees issued by that Ayatollah has the force of law. You have to obey it. Now, Hassan Nasrallah, I don't know about the present leader of Hezbollah, but Hassan Nasrallah was a follower of Ayatollah Khamenei. In other words, he was not equal to Ayatollah Khamenei. He was a follower of Ayatollah Khamenei, which means that he had to obey, religiously speaking. In addition to financial reasons that he had to obey, that in terms of his religious conviction, he had to follow the teaching and the decrees of Ayatollah Khamenei. I would say the relationship, again, was based on mutual respect, but ultimately Iran had the upper hand. There is no question about it.
Okay, that's very helpful. Let's contrast this with Yemen and Iran's relationship with the Houthis, which in your book, it comes off as a very different relationship, a pretty new relationship, and a completely different setting. Could you describe, I guess, a little bit about, you know, a little bit about their relationship, which of course would require a little bit of history, I guess, but yeah.
Yes. The Houthis, their relationship with Iran, it started very differently. And I think even today, Iran does not have the kind of control that it once had over Hezbollah, over the Houthis. And the reason is because unlike Hezbollah, the Houthis, they were able to establish, they start their movement independent of Iranian support. And they, right after the Islamic Revolution, as I said, a delegation of Lebanese went to Iran and they were given an audience to meet Ayatollah Khomeini. That means a lot. And remember, the Lebanese are Shias, so are the Iranians, but they belong to the same sect within Shia Islam. I read somewhere that there are over 1,000 different Christian churches that have been identified, over 1,000. Now, there are many different sects within Sunniism as well as within Shia Islam. Now, the Houthis in Yemen, there are Shias, but there are different kind of Shias than the 12 Shias or the Shias of Lebanon and Iraq and Iran and Azerbaijan and a lot of other countries. The leader of the Houthis went to Iran during Iran-Iraq war. He went to, he couldn't obtain a visa easily, so he went to Syria. And then through Syria, he ended up going to Iran in the 1980s. We know there is absolutely no evidence that he was given an audience to Ayatollah Khomeini. That should tell you all you need to know. Mm. In other words, Iran was not giving the kind of importance to him and to the movement he was about to start. The Houthis were much below in terms of foreign policy priorities of the Islamic Republic than Hezbollah.
Is this because they were Zaydi rather than Twelver? Is the religious part of it, or is it just that it wasn't considered an important area for the Iranian Republic?
For a variety of reasons. Religion, I think, wasn't as important, maybe, as the fact that at that time, during the war with Iraq, both Yemen, more or less were supporting Iraq. And also, Iran did not think it has really any strategic interest in right. Yemen, and did not see the, I think my own view is that the main reason is because they said that there is very little chance the Houthis can do anything right. substantial. And that's why they he wasn't given an audience. There is no evidence that Iran provided any financial support to them. Although once the leader of Houthis returned to Yemen and started the Houthi movement, Iran started providing limited support to the Shias there in terms of cultural support, educational support. But things began to change after the end of the Iran-Iraq war, when the Yemeni's government, under the leadership of Abdullah Saleh, who was very close to the Americans and very close to the Saudis, he started accusing Iran of providing financial support to the Houthis. And the Iranians kept denying that. And as I document in my book, various CIA documents, released CIA documents, shows that the Americans privately disagreed with the assessment that Iran is playing a major role in empowering the Houthis in Yemen. But the Yemeni's government took advantage of the fact that at that time it was very beneficial financially and politically to oppose the Islamic Republic. And they used that in order to get American support. We know there was one meeting between Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the foreign minister of Yemen, in which Clinton explicitly stated that you have not made your case that Iran actually financially supports the Houthis. The American ambassador at that time wrote a few cables to Washington and shared some of it with the Yemeni's official. He was a wise man and made a very accurate analysis that, look, the Houthis are an indigenous movement. They want to have a share in the political decision-making, and the government of Saleh, Abdullah Saleh, is well advised to try to address this politically and not militarily. But Saleh didn't listen, and then after 2011, with the start of the Arab Spring, people took to the streets and overthrew the Saleh government. And it is from that moment, from 2011, that Iran really began to provide serious military and training support to the Houthis, which eventually led to the Houthis taking over part of Yemen.
Right. Okay. So, so I guess in a sense, and there's a lot more to talk about, of course, and I again urge everybody to buy and read your book, which we'll post links to. But I think now let's bring it up to the present tense, which would require also explaining a bit the relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRI, and Hamas and the PIJ and the war. And so I think maybe if we could real briefly discuss Iran's relationship with Hamas and the PIJ, which is so fascinating because those are Sunni Islamists and Iran, of course, is Shia. And in so many other theaters, Shia and Sunni have not at all seen eye to eye, particularly in the Gulf. If you could explain that a bit.
Absolutely. One of the key points that your listeners should understand about Iranian regional policy, and in that context, Iran's relationship with the Houthis, with Iraqi militias, with Hezbollah, all of which can be summarized in the concept of axis of resistance. Mm-hmm. The key planner, the man who played a key role in shaping the axis of resistance was General Qasem Soleimani, who was killed in January of 2020 by the United States in Iraq through a drone and missile attack. He essentially formed the axis of resistance around the turn of the century. From the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution, Iran supported the Palestinian cause. In fact, the first foreign official to visit Iran was none other than the leader of PLO, Mr. Yasser Arafat. He went to Iran. He was given an audience to Ayatollah Khomeini, And right after the audience, the key of the building of the Israeli mission to Iran was given to him. And that mission, that Israeli mission, became the mission of the PLO. But from the very beginning, Iran had a conflict with PLO and with Yasser Arafat. They were friends. Iranians supported the PLO. But a couple of things happened that complicated that relationship. Number one, Arafat supported Iraq during Iran-Iraq war. And a lot of Iranians felt betrayed because Iran had supported PLO so generously. Secondly, Ayatollah Khomeini and the Iranian revolutionaries from the very beginning, just like Hezbollah in Lebanon, they did not trust nationalistic and more moderate Palestinian opposition.
Secular,
they wanted to have Islamic-oriented individuals.
Right.
And eventually, when Hamas was formed as the offshoot or as the Palestinian or as the Gaza branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, and when Palestine Islamic Jihad was established, again, people don't understand that Iran had nothing to do with the establishment of these two Palestinian organizations. Yes, Iran provided support, but it did so after these organizations were formed. But ideologically speaking, Iran felt very close to these two organizations because they too, both Hamas as well as PIJ, they were very critical of the PLO. And that's why first PIJ established very close relationship with Iran, and Iran provided huge financial support to them, military support to them. And then Hamas also received financial and military support years after it was established in Israel. In fact, the founder of Hamas went to Iran, met with Ayatollah Khomeini, and they both agreed that the only salvation, the only way for Palestinian freedom and Palestinian salvation is not through the PLO, but through an Islamic resistance. And that's why they were sort of partners throughout the past two decades. Now, going back to the axis of resistance, Qasem Soleimani was the one who came up with the idea that in order to combat America, in order to develop deterrence against U.S. threat to Iran, in order to complicate, in order to make things difficult for the state of Israel and to undermine state of Israel, it is important to establish a network, a secret network of various organizations, both Shi'i as well as Sunni, because as you correctly said, Hamas and PIJ are both Sunni organization. But Qasem Soleimani's idea was that individually, there is not much any of these organizations can do. But if they can become part of a cohesive, coherent, and disciplined underground and secret organization, they can really foment trouble for the United States and for the state of Israel. And it was in that context that the notion of forward defense strategy became the cornerstone or the foundation of Iranian foreign policy. Essentially, forward defense strategy means we cannot, we being Iranians, we cannot defeat America in conventional warfare. They're way too stronger than we are. But if we can develop asymmetrical warfare strategies, and if we can go and use our resources in areas beyond Iranian borders, then we can undermine American interests should America ever decide to attack Iran. That was the sort of a justification, strategic justification, for creating that axis of resistance, which essentially included various Iraqi militias, the Houthis, PIJ, Hamas, and of course Hezbollah, and most importantly, the only state, the Arab state that supported it, Assad, Bashar al-Assad, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, in Iraq. The key moment for the formation of Axis of Resistance, in fact, the key moment for what I have called Iranian rise in the Middle East, came in March of 2003, right, when President Bush made a decision to invade and occupy Iraq. That was a blessing in disguise for Iran. It was what I call in my book a strategic gift, unintended strategic gift by the United States to Iran. Why? Because historically, Iraq has always been a bastion of a fortress against Iranian expansion, mm-hmm, into the Arabian Peninsula, as well as to the Levant, Lebanon, Syria, and Israel. And once that fortress collapsed, when the American forces invaded Iraq and toppled Saddam Hussein rather quickly, Iran had an opportunity for the first time since the Persian and Ottoman Empire signed an agreement in 1700s that essentially gave control of most of Iraq to the Ottomans. For the first time now, Iran saw an opportunity to expand its power in the Middle East. So in many ways, the American invasion of Iraq became a catalyst, became a critical and needed catalyst for the ability of Iran to expand its power. And it is at that time that also the Axis of Resistance is formed, and Iran develops it in order not only to expand its power, but also to build deterrence against the United States and against Israel. Now, remember, in 2003, when America invaded Iraq and sent a couple of 100,000 troops, Afghanistan was already occupied by U.S. troops.
Right.
And Afghanistan is also an Iranian neighbor. So in many ways, in 2003, Iran felt being sandwiched, being suffocated, right, by American troops operating in Afghanistan, by NATO troops operating in Afghanistan, and by American troops operating in Iraq. And don't forget, America had bases in the Persian Gulf, and the Iranians felt as if the doomsday is about to be set on Iran. That's why Qasem Soleimani played such an important role in developing Iranian strategy, because he decided that if we sit idle, America is going to come and attack Iran. Therefore, he decided to support anti-American forces in Iraq, anti-American forces everywhere in the Middle East.
So that brings us, I mean, again, there's a lot that we're skipping over here that's all in the book. But let us move now to the post-October 7th world, which is that it seemed that Soleimani and the people came after him, that they had created a chessboard, if you will, you know, of forces that that allowed Iran to project power, and that were kind of that sort of that did protect Iran. And it was on the assumption that there would never be a kinetic direct war. Well, on a couple of assumptions. One is that there wouldn't be kinetic direct war between Iran and Israel or Iran and the US. And the other one was that Hezbollah could not fall, because Hezbollah was probably the most effective fighting force, you know, state or non-state, in the Middle East, as we saw in 2006. And instead, Israel crossed lines, and then the U.S. too, that were thought to be sort of uncrossable, or achieved, from their point of view, successes that were not thought achievable. And a lot of this happened literally just after you put your manuscript to bed. The killing of Nasrallah, which is huge, and the sort of declawing to a certain extent of Hezbollah was the main one. And then, of course, losing Assad, the Assad regime, which is replaced by a very hardcore Sunni anti-Shia regime under Jolani. And now they have faced, now Iran is facing direct war. And one thing I found so fascinating in your book, going back to the Iran-Iraq war, when Ayatollah Khomeini, the original, was still in power, is that there's been this consistent and very pragmatic strategy, which is you try your best to avoid getting into a direct conflict with the U.S. or Israel. There's an acknowledgement that they are militarily too powerful and that you do everything but accept that. I mean, even Ayatollah Khomeini, you saw this in 1988 when there was some direct kinetic conflict between the Iranians and the Americans. And Khomeini even then seemed to say from your book, we must not get into a direct conflict with the U.S. And now it's happening. So I guess my question is, what is left of that strategy, that 20-year-old strategy of Soleimani's, and what does that mean? If it's tattered and gone, what do you think Iran will do in its place?
As all your previous questions, this is also a fantastic question. And I have to congratulate you, because as a teacher, I always tell my students, and I don't mean that you or the audience are my students, I'm just telling you my mindset, is that you know a great deal about somebody's knowledge, depth of his or her knowledge, based on the questions they ask, not necessarily based on the answers they give. So you've been asking fantastic questions.
And we do our reading.
Yes, and this one is a really critical question. You are absolutely right. Let me answer it this way. I think the killing of Qasem Soleimani in 2020 ignited or started the decline of Iranian power in the region. The reason is because Qasem Soleimani was a unique character, an exceptional military commander, a very charismatic leader. Of course, many people consider him to be, especially in the U.S., consider him to be a terrorist, a first-rate terrorist. But a lot of people in Iran praise him for being a military hero. But what made him exceptional was that, A, he's the one who built that axis of resistance from the get-go. He knew all the characters. Mm-hmm. He knew the fault line of the regions. He had developed personal and religious relationship with all of these guys. And most importantly, he had complete control of making decisions on spot, bypassing bureaucratic debates, bypassing calling Tehran and say, can I do X or Y? He was a commander who was in the battlefields, I think sometimes recklessly, but he would be there and he could make on-spot decisions. And most importantly, and I can't emphasize that enough, he believed in both defensive and offensive operations. Mm-hmm. Once he died, I think Iran has been unable to replace anyone that comes even close to Qasem Soleimani's vision. And I'm not using the word vision in a positive or negative way. I'm using it in a very neutral way. And two things happened. Number one, Iran's control over the axis, I think, gradually diminished. Mm. Again, because of the central role of Qasem Soleimani in building that structure. Secondly, more importantly, I think Iranian regional policy became much less offensive much less offensive and essentially reactive and defensive in nature. Now, with this background, I have to tell you, a series of events in the Middle East after he was killed accelerated Iranian decline in the region and questioned whether Iran can actually control and use the access to advance its interest. The head of Hamas was killed in Tehran when he went to the inauguration of President Pezeshkian.
Right. Ismail Haniyeh, right?
Haniyeh, yes. Yeah, Ismail Haniyeh was killed. We don't know how he was killed. And frankly, it doesn't matter how he was killed. What matters is that Israel was able to penetrate Iranian intelligence parameters and kill one of the most important guests in the inauguration of Mr. Pezeshkian. This was then, of course, even before that, the Israelis had attacked the annex to the Iranian consulate in Damascus, for which Iran, for the first time, sent missiles and drones to Israel. But with the U.S. help, Israel was able to intercept most of those missiles and drones, and there were slight damages to Israelis. But then this continued, and when Hassan Nasrallah was killed, that was a turning point. He was killed, not only he was killed, but a high official of Iranian Revolutionary Guard was in that hideout. He too was killed. And your listeners know all about the story of the pagers and how the Israelis used that to undermine Hezbollah. But the single greatest setback for Iran was the fall of the Assad regime in Syria, because Assad, Syria was the conduit, a safe bridge for transferring Iranian arms to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Moreover, Hezbollah had played with Iran's backing. And I have a whole chapter on Syria and the role Hezbollah and the Revolutionary Guards played in keeping President Assad in power during the devastating civil war in Syria. But once Hezbollah was weakened, that important source of support for Syria disappeared. And when Assad collapsed, really without putting much fight, he escaped, he ran away to Russia. And I believe the defeat of Assad was the single greatest strategic setback for Iran in the past two or three decades. It was very much like the collapse of the Shah in 1979, when it was a devastating blow to American national interests in the region. I think here too, the fall of Assad's regime was a serious blow. And to be honest with you, I was surprised how quickly he disappeared, but I was also surprised of how quickly al-Shara, the interim president or now president, became president of Syria because, you know, he was detained by the United States from 2006 to 2011 for fighting with al-Qaeda in Iraq. He was then released at the start of the Syrian uprising. I don't know why, but he was released. And then he went to Syria, started fighting against Assad, and he founded another terrorist organization called Al-Nusra Front, which later on became HTS, which is the organization that Washington labeled as terrorist. And as all of you probably know, U.S. government had a $10 million bounty on the head of the current president of Syria. But having said all of this, this was a major defeat for the Islamic Republic. But the worst for Iran, perhaps the worst in the past history, in the history of the Islamic Republic, came on June, if I'm not mistaken, 13, 2025. And in Operation Rising Lion, Israel surprisingly unleashed waves of missiles and drones and warplanes against nuclear sites, military bases, missile factories, command centers, and even civilian targets, like state television headquarters, mm-hmm. or Tehran's notorious event prison, where political prisoners are housed. I think it is not unreasonable to agree that there is some accuracy to the reports that Mossad or its collaborators were able to smuggle and assemble drone components inside Iran, which then were used to disable Iranian air defenses, establishing air superiority and supremacy for Israel. Within 48 hours, here is the most fascinating aspect of this operation. Within 48 hours, Iranian military and scientific elite were decimated. More than 20 senior commanders. Please think about this. I'm not talking about regular commanders. I'm talking about most senior military commanders, including the IRGC commander-in-chief, including Iran's chief of staff, including the commander of the most important headquarters for internal operations of IRGC, and including the head of the IRGC Aerospace and Missile Force. They were all killed within 48 hours. And also, they were 14 nuclear scientists, all tied to sensitive nuclear projects. All of them were killed. That, I think, is an incredible success, military success for Israel. No question about that. It showed that they had deeply penetrated Iranian intelligence. It showed that they can deliver. And it showed that Mr. Bibi Netanyahu is willing to take a big risk. Because if this would have failed, imagine what kind of Middle East we would have today. Yeah. So in many ways, this loss of battlefield leadership and technical expertise was perhaps the most humiliating episode in history of the Islamic Republic. Of course, the claim was that, the Israeli claim was that Iran was about to build a nuclear bomb
right.
within 2 weeks. However, we all know that month earlier, Director of National Intelligence,
yeah.
Tulsi Gabbard, had testified before Congress that the intelligence community agreed that Iran was not pursuing a nuclear weapon. And here is what I also want to add to that, and that is, as impressive as this military operation was, equally impressive, and that's the part that is not given enough credit in Western media. Equally impressive was the ability of Iran's top leadership to quickly, mm-hmm. to quickly replace the slain commanders. And within 24 hours, they were able to start sending missiles to Israel. That is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And the idea, I don't know whether it was Israel's second top priority or third, but definitely it must have been one of their objectives. They thought that they went to Iran to destroy Iran's nuclear facilities, no doubt about it. But it is not unreasonable to assume that Israel and perhaps the United States also hoped that the sudden killing of Iran's top leadership and command centers would fracture the ruling elite, mm-hmm. would spark unrest, destabilize the regime and eventually maybe even overthrow the Islamic Republic. But that proved to be wishful thinking. Although Iranians were disoriented, but as I said, the Islamic Republic quickly replaced those who were killed and regained its footing. And I have to tell you, years from now, how Israel penetrated Iran and militarily killed the top officials of Iranian government would be taught in war colleges, but also they would be teaching how Iran withstood that pressure and was able to regroup itself and survive the attack. Both of these are fascinating aspects of that attack. Now, as a result of this today, and that's perhaps the final point I want to make, today there is no question that Israel's surprise attack dealt serious blows to Iran's enrichment facilities. However, Israel lacked the weapons to destroy Iran's most fortified underground sites at Fardo, which is a symbol of Iran's nuclear program. Although at first the United States provided support to Israel, supported in terms of intelligence, coordination, and personnel, etc., Washington finally decided to directly get involved in the war on June 21 and June 22, 2005. They launched, if I remember, long-range missiles, and they using Tomahawk missiles to degrade the Iranian defenses, and then B-2 bombers with massive ordnance penetrators against Fardo and other facilities. This was the first time the United States, in the history of its relationship with Iran that goes back to at least 150 years, was directly attacking Iran. Yes, they sent troops in World War II, but that was very different. This was the first time that they were attacking. President Trump claimed that he had obliterated Iranian nuclear facilities, which, of course, was challenged by some members of the U.S. government. But the key
DIA.
Thing,
and
the poor guy got fired later. But the key is that we don't know the extent of the damage. But even more important than that, Iran has refused to tell us the fate of its 60% enriched uranium stockpile, about 500 kilos, creating and cultivating ambiguity about intention and plans. Now, this attack has created, it has become a turning point in Iran because, as I explained in the book, the Cold War between Iran and the United States started after the hostage crisis, which is a fascinating story.
Yes.
And I think it was an awful story in the history of the two countries. Iran made a huge mistake by supporting the hostage taking, and it ignited the Cold War. But that Cold War essentially stayed as Cold War. Now we have entered, after the U.S. directly attacked Iran, a new chapter has started between the United States and Iran. And I just want to tell you that what I see in Iran is further polarization of Iranian society in a way that I haven't seen it since the end of the Iran-Iraq war. And I am the first to tell you, I don't know what direction Iran is going to take. There is no question the axis of resistance has been weakened, profoundly weakened, but the axis of resistance is not out. Mm-hmm. Iran has the option, and I'll talk about it in a second, of regrouping it. It is also important to remember, yes, Hezbollah has been weakened, but Hezbollah has not been totally disarmed yet.
Absolutely.
Hamas has been weakened profoundly, but we do not know the fate of Gaza and West Bank. Mm. Anything can happen there. Most importantly, there is no evidence that the Iraqi militias have been damaged seriously, although we do know that the Houthis have been damaged somewhat. But the Houthis are incredible fighters. Mm-hmm. They can take a kind of damage and death and destruction that I don't think any other member of the Axis of resistance can take. Right. So the Axis is weakened, but it is not. It has not been destroyed. Now there are two different camps, two different paradigms, are developing in this polarized environment in Iran. And I don't know which one Iran is going to take. One is some hardliners who basically argue that we need to double down on our forward defense strategy. We need to regroup, reconstitute Axis of resistance. Why do they say that? Their argument is that, look, when did Israel and America attack Iran?
Right.
They attack Iran when Hezbollah was weakened.
Right.
They attack Iran when Assad was out of power. They attack Iran when Hamas was under fire. So that means that the Axis of resistance was effective.
Right.
And therefore, what we need to do is to revive it. But they go further than that. There is one element of that camp, and they're very outspoken. And I have been observing Iranian politics and its nuclear program for over three decades now. I've never seen anything like it. There is one segment of that faction that now is openly calling for Iran to take the nuclear path. They say that regardless of Iran's ability to reconstitute the axis of resistance, American attack on Iran, Israeli attack on Iran, has proven that Iran needs to develop a nuclear bomb as its ultimate deterrence against these two countries. Now, against that school of thought, there are moderate forces in Iran that essentially say that we should not go back to this strategy of forward defense, that it was useless from the very beginning. We should not pursue Iran's Islamic interests. Instead, we should focus on pursuing Iranian national interests. Mm. They say that we should abandon enrichment in Iranian soil, that we should move toward normalizing relations with the U.S., and negotiating with the U.S. and be reintegrated into the global economy. Hmm. Which side, which direction Iran is likely to take? The direction of defiance or the direction of serious negotiations with the U.S.? What makes that very complicated, very complex, is that two unknowns. Two uncertain things that can shape the future of Iran. One, the succession to the 86-year-old supreme leader. Who's going to replace him? Which camp will he belong? And secondly, is there going to be another attack by Israel or Israel and U.S. on Iran? And so, if you are a little bit more confused about Iran now than you were at the beginning of this podcast, I want to congratulate you, because that was my intention, to tell you that Iran is a complex country and its politics is complex, and you have to agree, you have to be content with accepting some degree of uncertainty about the future of that country. It has been a great pleasure to talk to you. It has been an honor for me, and I hope that your listeners enjoyed the program.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I am confused in only the best ways. But actually, no, you've clarified a lot. And again, I'm going to recommend people interested in this topic, which is should be just about every one of our subscribers, to get Mohsen Milani's book, Iran's Rise and Rivalry with the United States. As you can hear, you get both history and which war nerds all love history too. But and then also you get really clear threads that explain a lot and clarify a lot about what's going on today. Thank you so much.
And if you don't mind, let me add one other point, and that is at times I deliberately try to be ambiguous, deliberately try not to answer your question so that I can encourage your readers to buy the book and get the answer.
Yes, good. Okay, well, thank you again so much.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, that concludes part two of our interview with Mohsen Malani. Again, links to his book, we'll put those in the comments. Thanks again, everyone. Thank you to Mohsen for taking all that time talking to us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks very much.
And talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.